Tonight we continue our study of another one of these nations from the Old Testament that were neighbors to the children of Israel that the Lord ultimately pronounced destruction upon, and that is the nation of the Amalekites. And we are planning in our study tonight to look at that judgment that God pronounced upon them being brought to pass with their destruction for their wickedness. Last week we studied the background of the nation, and the Amalekites were a nomadic people. They were not a large nation with a confined territory, quite like most of the other neighbors of the Israelites. But they dwelt in the area to the south of where the Philistines were. The Philistines were on the Mediterranean coast, on the west, southwest of the territory that God had given to the children of Israel. And south of where the Philistines dwelt, really in that desert region that bordered along particularly of the tribe of Judah's territory and nearby to some of the cities that were given to the children of Simeon, the Amalekites were there. And so the Lord pronounced destruction on them, and we saw the occasion for that with the first of the contacts that Israel had, or the first one that's recorded between Israel and the Amalekites. In the book of Exodus, chapter 17, verses 14 through 16, the children of Israel, when they were in journey in the wilderness, they were attacked by the Amalekites. Now, we saw in the background last week that Amalek was a grandson of Edom. So this was a nation that was also just like Edom was the descendants of Esau himself. Amalek was one of his grandsons, and Moab and Ammon were descendants of Lot. So a lot of those nations that were neighbors to Israel, particularly in those southern areas to the west and to the east, southwest and southeast, were related to them. The Amalekites attacked the Israelites when they were journeying in the wilderness in Exodus 17. On that occasion, Israel fought a battle with them when they were attacked. As long as Moses' arms were lifted, God was giving Israel victory as led by Joshua. Aaron and Hur were on either side of Moses to hold up his arms because they grew tired. He couldn't hold up his arms that long on his own, and so there was one on one side and the other on the other to hold his arms up. And Israel prevailed in that battle. But afterwards, in Exodus 17, 14 through 16, and this is reading a passage that we saw last week, but this is to remind ourselves what judgment God did pronounce on that nation and why. So in Exodus 17, 14 through 16, after that battle with the Amalekites and in this chapter, after Israel was attacked by them, it says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi, for he said, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." And actually, everything that we studied last week after that point through the chronology of the battles that Israel fought with the Amalekites through the period of the Judges and on up into the reign of King Saul is a record of God fighting with Amalek from generation to generation. But God pronounced the judgment not only that he was going to fight with them from generation to generation, but that he was going to put out their remembrance from under heaven. He was going to utterly destroy them. And then we had Numbers chapter 24, verse 20, what God spoke through the mouth of Balaam, who had the intention of cursing Israel, but God blessed Israel through Balaam. But he says there, when he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he perish forever. And we noted last week that that use of the word first does not mean always chronologically. And certainly the nation of the Amalekites was not the first nation chronologically in history to exist. But they did rank first on God's list. And it would certainly appear that that would relate to what was going to be the latter end of Amalek. And that's what the conclusion is there, that his latter end would be that Amalek would perish forever, just like God said in Exodus 17. And then we have Deuteronomy 25, 17 through 19, that repeats that sentence that God rendered upon the nation of the Amalekites, but he's very particular in why that was. And we see some more detail about that attack that Amalek made on the children of Israel that was recorded in Exodus 17. Deuteronomy 25, 17 through 19 says, Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way, when you were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way, and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. So that was, again, the utter destruction that God had sentenced the Amalekites to. But he gives the reason there. Amalek, well, they were wicked. I mean, that was the ultimate reason. But it was also directly tied to that attack on Israel. Now, when they attacked the Israelites, how did they do it? I mean, they took the opportunity that presented itself when they were journeying, and there they are, tired in their journey. They're not coming as a threat to the Amalekites themselves, but here Amalek takes advantage of their being in a journey in the wilderness. They were tired, they were faint. They all would have been, but then they also choose the back of their column that they're traveling in. And who would be in a journey of a nation like that, who would be the ones that would tend to be towards the back of the column as they're going along? Well, it's going to be the ones that are the weakest, the ones that are the most feeble. And they're going to be women and little children and elderly. And they attacked them. Those ones who were feeble behind them, and that took a degree of evil to plan and execute that kind of an attack, and they didn't fear God. They had no regard for that this was God's people, and they were willing to do that. So God said he was going to put out their remembrance from under heaven. So that judgment was going to be brought to pass. Now there in Deuteronomy 25, when was it going to happen? Well, Israel was still in the wilderness at the time that Deuteronomy 25 is written. This is before Moses died, but this is near the time when Joshua was going to succeed Moses as the leader of Israel, their judge, and as a prophet of the Lord. And then he was going to lead them into the land of Canaan. And God said it was going to be after they were conquered that land that then they were going to, they must not forget Amalek, and that's when they would destroy the Amalekites. But did he say it was going to be immediately when they went back, when they conquered the land? He did not. He said it would be after that time. How long did that turn out to be? Well, that turned out to be about 450 years past that time. So it was quite a distance in time from, at least certainly from man's perspective, from when God pronounced that judgment of utter destruction on the Amalekites to when that judgment began to be carried out. So we can ask the question, well, why the delay? Now, there are some times when, as we recently had a lengthy study about the Philistines, what was supposed to happen to the Philistines? Well, they were supposed to be utterly destroyed. They were part of those nations that God had sentenced to utter destruction, and commanded the children of Israel to utterly destroy them and to leave none remaining. And they were part of the ones that God gave their territory to Israel. But that was part of what God had spoken about back in Genesis 15 to Abraham. There was a delay of 400 plus years in that situation from when God had sentenced all those Amorite people to utter destruction before he gave the commandment to Israel, now is the time to carry it out. Well, they didn't. The Israelites partially obeyed that commandment, much like Saul would do concerning the Amalekites that we're about to read about in a few minutes, Lord willing. But they left alive, many of them, and they did not utterly destroy the Philistines, as we know. And they became a thorn and a snare to them. But in Genesis 15, 12 through 16, here's what God had said to Abraham that would be what was to be done with those people that were in the land of Canaan that Abraham was among at this time. But it was not going to be something that would happen immediately or within a generation or two. Genesis 15, 12 through 16 says, "And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Now, what nation was that? We know that was Egypt. He says, "And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance." Now, did all that happen with the Exodus from Egypt? Just like God said there, it did. Now, while they were languishing in Egypt for 400 years and being afflicted there, and he told Abraham, "And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, thou shalt be buried in a good old age." But what was going on at the same time in Canaan? And why did God leave them in Egypt for 400 years before giving them the land of Canaan for an inheritance, which was going to coincide with the utter destruction of the Amorites? He says, "But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." It wasn't yet complete. So God gave the reason there for the delay from the sentence of that utter destruction to carrying it out. And their wickedness had to reach completion, which God would know when that was. And I don't know of any man that would be able to see that and know when that point was reached. But God would and did. And that's why there was a 400-year delay in that case. Well, with the Amalekites, he sentenced them to utter destruction, but it's not until the reign of King Saul that God says now is the time. And that's around 450 years after God had sentenced them to utter destruction. Now, why was there the delay there? It could very well be the same thing as with the Amorites. Now, he doesn't tell us specifically like he does concerning the Amorites, like he told to Abraham, but it very well could be that. But God had a reason, whatever it was. He just doesn't tell us precisely what that reason is in for the Amalekites. But there was a similar time period as the destruction of the Amorite people to that of the Amalekites. So when we get to 1 Samuel chapter 15, now is the time that God says that judgment is to be carried out. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 1 through 9. Samuel also said unto Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore hearken unto the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." And Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 footmen and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to a city of Amalek and laid wait in the valley. And Saul said unto the Kenites, Now, who were the Kenites? We studied about them, that was a few years ago. Maybe we need to dust that one off. But does anybody remember who the Kenites are? Those were the descendants of Moses' father-in-law, Jethro. And they were not Israelites physically, but going back to the time of Moses' father-in-law, he joined himself together with God's people, with Israel. He recognized that they were the ones serving the God of heaven. And the Kenites, the descendants of Moses' father-in-law, stayed nearby the Israelites for the duration of what we read in the Old Testament. And they remained faithful to God. Actually, in the book of Jeremiah, it was one of their families that God gave as an example in how they maintained their faithfulness to their covenant, whereas the children of Israel didn't. So they were actually better people in following God than the Israelites themselves. So the Kenites had a tradition of faithfulness to God, which is very good. And so the Kenites, they had their dwelling nearby to the children of Israel. And they were, there were many of them in this region where these Amalekites were. And so Saul said unto the Kenites, "Go, depart, get you down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. Now, was that Saul's own idea? Very unlikely that it was. I mean, when did Saul ever do anything good like that? In fact, he doesn't do what God tells him to do here to the Amalekites fully. But no doubt that this was God's warning to the Kenites to spare them. And so God was returning the goodness of the Kenites to give them the opportunity to escape this destruction, not get caught up in it. And they took heed to that. So they were spared. So then what does Saul do with the Amalekites? Well, God was very clear in the instructions that he gave to them. "Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, people and animals." He was very specific. He was not to leave any alive of them or of the people or their animals. So it says here that Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until thou comest to Shur, that is over against Egypt, and he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that they destroyed utterly. So did Saul obey the commandment? He's going to claim he did, and argue steadfastly with the prophet Samuel, who was sent by God to rebuke him for his disobedience. Well, he had obeyed part of the commandment. In fact, we would actually, if you wanted to break it down percentage-wise, of all these Amalekite people there, he spared the king. But as far as the percentage of the people, on any test that we would ever take in school, we'd get a big A-plus for only missing one out of however many there were, right? But that's not how God grades obedience, is it? Either you obey fully or you disobeyed. And did he obey all the commandment, or was most of it good enough? Most of it wasn't good enough. God requires full obedience to all of his commandments. And if we haven't given that, then we haven't obeyed him. Saul disobeyed him. He did not carry forth and do exactly what God said. We read the commandment. He didn't follow it. He spared Agag, which was a disobedience, and he spared the best of their animals, which was also disobedience. Well, as we mentioned, he argued with Saul. We're not going to read all of his lame arguments, but in 1 Samuel 15, verses 17 through, not tonight, that's good reading for at another time, but we're trying to focus on the Amalekites right now, not so much King Saul. But 1 Samuel 15, 17 through 19 says, "And Samuel said, when thou wast little in thine own sight..." Now there's Saul's problem in a nutshell. He's no longer little in his own sight. He loves the praise and glory of the people. He wants to be big in their sight, and he's big in his own sight. But there was a time when he was little in his own sight. There was a time when... And when somebody, when you're small in your own sight, what's the word for that? It's being humble. And we need to be little in our own sight. We don't need to be some great thing in our own sight. Saul was at a time when he was humble. We can read about it when he was called forth to be anointed before all the children of Israel as king. And where was he? He was hiding among the stuff. There was a time when he was not what he was now. And he says, "When thou wast little in thine own sight, was thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed thee king over Israel? And the Lord sent thee on a journey and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites." And there's again why they were appointed to destruction. They were wicked. They were sinners. And God mentioned at the beginning of the chapter what they had done to the Israelites when they attacked them after they left Egypt. He says, and God said, "And go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then didst thou not obey the voice of the Lord, but didst fly upon the spoil, and didst evil in the sight of the Lord?" More arguments from Samuel. From Saul against Samuel, of course, against God. And of course, Saul ultimately loses the argument because he was guilty of disobedience. So in verses 32 and 33, here God said through Samuel, "Then said Samuel, bring ye hither to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came unto him delicately. And Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. And Samuel said, as thy sword hath made women childless, so shall thy mother go be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal." So Saul spared him, but Samuel did not. God had appointed him for destruction, and that's what happened to Agag. On that day, Samuel himself personally carrying out the that last part of the commandment as far as their people were concerned, that Saul had not, Agag was slain. And so the rest of the people of their people were. Now later in 1 Samuel 28, God was not answering Saul because Saul was wicked and Saul had not repented. So Saul was facing the Philistines. We studied about this not too long ago when we were studying about the Philistines. But they had gathered themselves against Israel and a battle was coming. Saul wanted to know what to do in the battle and how it would turn out. God was not answering him. God was not speaking to Saul because he had no regard for Saul anymore. He had rejected him because Saul had rejected the Lord. So what did Saul do? He added sin to his sin, and he went to a woman with a familiar spirit. What is the word for such? A witch. And went to her to summon up Samuel. And people do that today, don't they? There's seances and Ouija boards and all this kind of stuff. And some people think that's all funny and fun and games, but it isn't. It's witchcraft. It's false religion. We don't need to be caught up in that. And by the way, astrology and people that read horoscopes and all that, and everybody wants to know what their sign is. We don't need to be reading that stuff and get caught up in that and think there's anything to that. That's also a form of, that has its roots. That's another form of idolatry. If you want to see what that looks like in full bloom, go over to India. That is something we don't need to be involved in as Christians. That's not, we can't read the stars, and that's all based in idolatry and witchcraft. So we don't want to be caught up in that at all. But anyway, I know that's somewhat an aside for now. But Saul did that, and they were expressly forbidden from doing that in the by the Old Testament. God doesn't want us to be doing that today either. But Saul went to this witch to summon up Samuel, who was dead, so he could speak to Samuel. Now, could a witch really bring up the dead? And these people that go and spend this money and they go to see these people that are where they want to talk to their dead relatives that have long gone or whatever. Can they really converse with the dead? The answer is no. That can be demonstrated here very easily with what happened when Samuel actually did come and speak to Saul. It shocked the woman. Now, if she were used to that, if that's what was customary to her practice, then why would she have been shocked when he actually did appear? And there was only one reason for that, because that didn't happen. But God made it happen. God was the one that did that to rebuke Saul for what he was doing here. But notice what also he says in 1 Samuel 28:15-20. This is when Samuel spoke to Saul from the grave. So Samuel said to Saul, "Why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up?" And Saul answered, "I am sore distressed." He always has an excuse, doesn't he? "For the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me, and answereth me no more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do." Who's he actually blaming here? He's really blaming God. "I have to do this because God won't give me the answer, so I got to do it this way." He can rationalize. I mean, he's one of the all-time greats with that. But anyway, what does Samuel say in response? "Then said Samuel, Wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord has departed from thee and has become thine enemy? And the Lord hath done to him as he spake by me. For the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand and given it to thy neighbor, even to David. Here's where he says it. Because thou obeyest not the voice of the Lord, nor executed his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore hath the Lord done this thing unto thee this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me. The Lord also shall deliver the host of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." Then Saul fell straightway all along on the earth and was sore afraid because of the words of Samuel, and there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no bread all the day nor all the night. And he did die the next day. He was killed by the Philistines. But what situation did God bring up with why he wasn't speaking to him? And he mentioned specifically that commandment that he had not obeyed regarding the destruction of the Amalekites. That wasn't the only commandment he disobeyed. He was disobeying another one here. And he brought that up later too. But that was something that was a very serious sin. Not that any sin isn't, but he committed a great evil in not fulfilling what God had said to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Now later we read in, or actually it was in the previous chapter in 1 Samuel 27, what is David doing during the, as we're reaching near the end of Saul's life before David becomes accepted by his tribe of Judah and is anointed by them to be king, and then later the rest of the tribes of Israel. But what's David doing? Well, David has taken refuge among the Philistines under Achish, the king of Gath. And David, while he is in Achish, is wreaking havoc among the Amalekites. Now, this was a nomadic people. We read in 1 Samuel 27:5-12, it says, "David said unto Achish, If I have now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should thy servant dwell in the royal city with thee?" Then Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Wherefore Ziklag pertaineth unto the kings of Judah unto this day. And the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months. And David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites and the Gezerites and the Amalekites. For those nations were of old the inhabitants of the land, as thou goest to Shur, even to the land of Egypt. And David smote the land and left neither man nor woman alive, and took away the sheep and the oxen and the asses and the camels and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. And Achish said, "Whither have you made a road today?" And David said, "Against the south of Judah and against the south of the Jerahmeelites and against the south of the Kenites." And David saved neither man nor woman alive to bring tidings to Gath, saying, lest they should tell on us, saying, "So did David, and so will be his manner all the while he dwelleth in the country of the Philistines." And Achish believed David, saying, "He hath made his people Israel utterly to abhor him. Therefore he shall be my servant forever." Who's he fighting with? Well, it includes Amalekites. So were there any other Amalekites left after what happened in 1 Samuel 15? Obviously there were. Being a nomadic people, were there some other tribes out there that still needed to be put out of existence to fulfill God's sentence of destruction on all the Amalekites? Yes. And David carried that out. Some of them come and ransack Ziklag and took David's and his men's families captive. And then David went as God directed him in 1 Samuel chapter 30. And the whole chapter is really about that. But David fought against the Amalekites some more and destroyed them and recovered all the spoil and all the people that they had taken captive, and they lost no one. But David continued to fight against the Amalekites and through his days. And so he was continuing to put them down. Evidently, there was still a remnant, because we read in 1 Chronicles chapter 4, 39 through 43, in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. It says, and they went to the entrance of Gedor, even unto the east side of the valley, to seek pasture for their flocks. And they found the pasture and good, and the land was wide and quiet and peaceable, for they of Ham had dwelt there of old. And these written by name came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and smote their tents and the habitations that were found there, and destroyed them utterly unto this day, and dwelt in their rooms, because there was pasture there for their flocks. And some of them, even of the sons of Simeon, 500 men, went to Mount Seir, having their captains, Pelatiah, and Neariah, and Raphaiah, and Uzziel, the sons of Ishi, and they smote the rest of the Amalekites that were escaped, and dwelt there unto this day. And that's the last we read of them. So apparently there's a little bit left, and of course they're taking refuge there at Mount Seir. That's where the Edomites were, who were their close relatives, as they were also descended from Esau. But God, step by step, brought their utter destruction, as he said, and put out their remembrance from under heaven. So there we have another example of a wicked nation that God judged for all that wickedness. This goes along with what we read about the Philistines and what we've previously studied about the Edomites. And so it was true also of the others, the Ammonites and the Moabites and Tyre and Sidon, all these nations that were wicked. God ultimately judged them and has left them as an example of what God does to the ungodly. As we have read many times in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, he tells us that the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation, but to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. So God has given these examples in the Old Testament for us to learn from. There are many other lessons that are in the midst of these things that we study, as we saw about obedience to God and those things, like we read about King Saul and David and others. But with those nations themselves, God has preserved examples of his judgment of wickedness. So we can see ultimately what's going to happen to us if we follow ungodliness and unrighteousness in our lives, which we want to remember and not forget these lessons so that we don't follow those, end up with the eternal destruction that we'll be delivered into if we do not serve the God of heaven. Tonight is an opportunity for you, if you're here and not yet a Christian. This is a time for you that the Lord is providing to come forward and to obey his gospel, to become a child of God by repenting and being baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of your sins. We're encouraging you to do that now if that is your need, or if you are a member of the Lord's body and need to return to the Lord if you've gone astray from him. We're encouraging you to come also now. So anyone that needs to respond to the Lord's invitation, won't you please come now while we stand together and sing?